Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address. Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second episode of Informal Economics for Traders, featuring the informal economist himself, Eric Mason. And joining me again tonight is Vanta Trading's Mr. Banks, who has a nice brand new webcam that nobody can see on this audio only recording.
He's looking good. The audience needs to know he's looking pretty good.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. let's see. What did we do last? Last month, we looked at some of the basic principles along with economic indicators like GDP, inflation, and unemployment numbers, and how you can really like dig into the data to really understand it. Tonight, however, we're going to be diving into the world of fiscal and monetary policy and how those impact the financial markets. Before we kick things off, anybody listening along has any questions, comments, or just wants to share something nice with us, please feel free to send us a message either by Discord or email at bandoftraderspodcast@gmail.com, or you can even go to the Informal Economist's website and take advantage of the Google Forms. We'll have links for everything in the show notes, but for now, I think it's time to let Eric answer the questions from last session.
Yeah, so first off, I do very much appreciate anytime somebody fills out one of those Google form and submit me a question. As I was talking to Kyle, Mr. Banks before this, actually a lot of the questions I get are very clearly freshmen and sophomores in college trying to get me to their homework. These clearly weren't, so I was very happy about that. So the first question comes from just real quick, anybody listen to this who I usually respond back. Not trying to put you on blast, just didn't get an email in the email category, so I couldn't respond back. So I'll answer these, with Kyle and Mr. Banks. So this one comes from, I'm not going to use last names, but this comes from somebody named Blake. And they ask, what are the early warning signs in the economy that hint at a market crash? Like, what is a sign that makes you buy gold and beans? Which I do love that.
Why beans?
Yeah, I'm very curious about beans. I don't know. They're like, are they more economic?
Beans economic or reserve? Beans?
Oh, beans. I think they mean like survival.
Like soybeans. Like conditions.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Or like the beans, like you're bartering with Native Americans.
Yes, exactly. Either one is probably fine.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, this is actually like a really good question because I think if you ask that to an economist versus asking that to a trader, I think you get two very different answers. I think a lot of economists are going to say the same answer. I think a lot of traders are going to say the same answer, but I think they're going to be kind of different. But I don't think either one's really wrong. So to me, like the early warning sign that there's going to be a slowdown or a recession is at first I look for weakening labor data. And we talked a little bit about that on the first episode in the series. Like, if we start to see unemployment month over month really growing, if we start to see disposable income decline, those are really signs that something's about to happen. I know we talked about like the signs of a recession and what economic decline is really based on investment. That's certainly still true. But, investment's a long-term metric we're looking at. These are short-term signs that kind of usually pre-warn of a recession. And you have seen that play out in the media a little bit where people see like these large tech companies like laying off people. And like, is that a sign of a recession? I don't know. I'm looking for more like broad market data, like just look clean across the economy. If there's a sudden decline in employment or like job posting suddenly decline, you know, that could really signal like some weaker balance sheets. And these companies are trying to trim costs.
But more than just tech, though, right? You said you want that across like broad trends.
Yeah, you know, kind of like exactly. Like it should be like a broader trend. I know industry specific slowdowns are kind of to be expected, but they don't really. Depending if you're pretty diversified, I don't think, you know, industry specific trends like that are inherently signs of a recession. They're not. I don't think they're inherently indicative of one. Mm-hmm. But if you start seeing a broad market, yeah, that'd really give me a moment of pause. It would definitely give me a moment of pause.
Okay, so that's the economist answer.
Yeah, that is the economist answer.
So Mr. Banks, he mentioned that the trader may have a different opinion on what precurses a recession. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that, like what things scare you from the economy as a broader whole.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, obviously, when you start seeing the metrics come in and they're complete misses, you know, like you saw in 2020 and you know, a couple of these things where you start to see just absolute misses by companies, absolute misses on reporting and, you know, unemployment, mm-hmm. GDP. And, but it's interesting, like in 2020, I mean, that kind of started right before COVID, before it actually kind of went, you know, you started to see this with like cruise line companies and like travel companies. And so it's interesting. I mean, in the sense of like calling tops and calling bottoms and stuff like that, it's, I mean, that's incredibly hard to do. If you know how to do it, let me know.
Right. You know?
But in the sense of like,
talk to you. Yeah,
you know, but in the sense of like, cause I kind of see it from both sides. Cause you know, being in the banking industry, you kind of get to see a little bit, of the background of how people spend money. You know, mm-hmm. You know, dealing with companies every day, you start to see small layoffs, you start to see increase in pricing, you start to see, you know, that inflation risk. So you know, from my side of it, I kind of get the small business feel of it. So you kind of get to see a little bit of both. From just a straight trader standpoint, I would say, you know, a lot of traders probably don't look or go into detail on a lot of those reporting, like unemployment, GDP, in the sense of what actually causes the market to go down or up. I think most people kind of look at the news in the sense of it's liquidity, but that news really doesn't play an idea of what that trade is.
Right.
So in the sense of like looking at like, you know, like in 2020, I mean, when you started to see, you know, bigger layoffs, you started to see bigger misses on reporting, even company reporting, like when earnings were coming out and stuff like that. I mean, you know, when you start to see stuff like that, to me, that it's a cause for concern. And then the bank side of it, being from that side of it, you know, when I start getting questions about like CD rates, and you know, especially when we have like very low rates, where there's just a cause for concern of people wanting to be out of the market. And even like, I mean, you know, if you're working, you know, 9 to 5, I mean, people start asking, just, you know, coworker going back and forth, you know, you start to hear the talk of like, you know, the 401k talk of, you know, yes. You know, should I do this or should I do that? You know, I've had a drop of, you know, 2% or 3% this month. Do you think that we're going to start to see a bigger push? So I think you can kind of, from a trader standpoint, you can kind of get little tidbits from multiple different outlets, on how you look at stuff. Now the key is putting it all together and making it make sense. You know, it's easy to say in 2023 that 2020 was a terrible year, but when you're in the moment and you really look at it, you know, when you start to see these reports, like, you know, okay, you miss on one report on unemployment. Well, you miss on it again, and then you miss on it again. I mean, that's kind of a red flag to start tearing up. And then, you know, when you get into a day where the market is just going completely down and you start buying like spots of just, you know, support that should hold or should have at least have some sort of reaction that is just right. Getting absolutely no respect, you know, and that happens on a daily basis now. But when you start seeing that day over day over day over day, that's kind of alarming, you know, on that standpoint.
Yeah. I want to piggyback on the 401k talk that you mentioned there, because the other one is when, like, you've got relatives or the, you know, the mailman delivering your mail is asking you about the stock market. Like, when those kinds of things start happening, when your cab driver is giving you tips or things that he's looking at, like, yeah, then it's time to start looking for maybe, you know, protecting yourself.
Yeah. Which, I mean, you talk to any, you talk to any financial advisor. I mean, at that point, it's just a matter of, like, if you're going to be in the market for a long time, it's just a matter of leveraging yourself in a sense as it's coming down. You can't pull out of the market in the sense of, like, when you're looking at it. But our jobs as traders is that when we're deciding when to enter a trade on a daily basis is piecemealing that into how, you know, what you want your bias to be, how you're going to take that trade. And that's where it becomes a lot harder, because when you have these reporting, you know, reports and stuff like that, I would say the vast majority of when I started to trade, you know, I'd be like, oh, well, it's a great report, we should go up. Or it's a bad report, we should go down. And then I started to realize, like, wow, they just don't care at all what is happening. You know, these reports print, you know, it's a great report on jobs and we go down 200 points on the NASDAQ. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me. But then you start to realize, like, it's kind of built in on price and it's kind of built in through time. Exactly. But I think the more you get into trading, the more you realize that the market is painting a story before it happens, and the news is only the reaction of it. You know, it gives it,
the news is how they get their positions filled.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Mr. Banks, you're like 100% right. The market bakes in that information. It's the marginality of it. I mean, one of the weirdest parts of me is that, you know, we sell bonds, you know, even after a good job report, like, I'll see really strong bond rates and I'm like, wow, we just had a killer job report. Yeah, I shouldn't be selling tax-free bonds at this, you know, such a low price for us. And I'm like, well, the market already baked it in. It's the change in expectations. So you can have, like, a, you know, a 100,000, you know, 100,000 job beat. And if the market thought it was going to be $125, the market goes down. And that is, I mean, it's the beauty of capitalism. The market's just so smart. But Mr. Banks, 100% agree with you, buddy. It's like, you know, when you, sometimes it just feels confusing. It feels like it's upside down.
I mean, the way I treated news events in the past was just let it happen. I'll wait for the reaction and then I'll go back and look and see if I can figure out why. But really, it doesn't help you so much in the moment. And I'm hoping that maybe the conversations we have today might help fix some of that.
Hopefully. So there was one other question.
Did we fully answer Charlie's question? I think we gave plenty of time.
I think we did, actually.
Okay.
I will say he called me out. He says, I know you hate bricks. I just want, like, I just, but I'm talking more broadly. And I was like, that's awesome.
I did want to point out that Egypt joined. I was wondering if that was the one that was going to scare you.
What are they on? They're on their third IMF loan in 10 years. Wait, was I not supposed to say that?
No.
No, I don't think I was. I'm not scared of countries that, you know, don't have enough water. Economic powerhouses.
Right.
The threat to blow up an Ethiopian dam just so you can have enough water to flush a toilet. I don't necessarily think that makes you an economic juggernaut.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. What was the other question?
So the first question was Blake. This is Charlie's. It was, this is actually probably, you know, a better question for you guys than for me, to be honest. But it says, how do big global moves like trade deals or currency changes translate to the stock market and my own investments? And then he goes, I know you hate bricks, but I'm talking about it broadly. So Charlie, I don't know if you're flaming me a little bit in that last section, but I will continue my hatred of bricks. Now my only problem, I don't want to sound like I'm crapping on Charlie, because I do like the answer. I'm not doing this on purpose, but I don't know what your investments are, so I don't know how to, like, really. I can't wait till he's all in rupee or something like that. Oh my god. My bad. I thought it was a good question. I don't know, how do you guys react to that? Like, you know, especially like spot traders and day traders and stuff like that. Like, when you see a major news, like if you see, like, I don't know, like you see Egypt, you see they basically ran out of foreign currency reserve because they decided to shut down like a bunch of their gas fields, and now they don't have any dollars or euros. Actually, they sold a bunch of dollar denominated bonds and now they can't pay them back because their currency devalued to 50% of the US dollar in a year. Like, does that make you change as a trader? Like, Mr. Banks, you're at the intersection of this stuff right now. Like, what are your thoughts on this?
So you're talking about them, like them joining and kind of deals that are put in place for like trade and stuff like that?
Yeah. Like how do you, you know, not to, to flip this around, but like, you know, you hear something like that. You hear like a big, you know, you hear IMF's involved in some country. Like, does that even go on your radar and how you look at a trade? Like, does that, do you, does your exposure, do you think your exposure increases or decreases when you hear that? Because I have the economic answer. It's incredibly, it's probably kind of, it's probably kind of boring or a little like, yeah. But the answer is,
not,
we don't trade currencies.
Yeah.
Really,
I don't really trade a lot of currencies. I do trade bonds, but, you know, for that standpoint, I mean, it doesn't really affect me in the sense of how I place a trade, because, you know, typically when you're looking at that, you know, it's kind of like the news, like that deal has been put into place and it's kind of just waiting for the signatures. So if it's something like, right, you know, well, you know, something like where there's like sanctions or something, like something that is just un, you know, you're not really looking for something and it's just, it comes out in day, you know, this is a sanctions against Russia or whatever. Like when that happened, no one realized that we were going to do that until it happened. You know, when you, when you talk about like war news, like I don't think anyone really planned on Russia invading Ukraine or something along those lines. But when you're talking about like these trade deals, like I feel like those are, you know, unless it's, I don't know a trade deal that's not public before it happens.
Yeah, right.
You know, but
that's a great point. That's a,
you know, they're like in today's world, like there's reporting on everything. You know, like that's the gist of what market reporters are supposed to do, is find these answers, or at least put out there the speculation of it. So, like, you know, and did you say Egypt joined? Is that what you said?
I think Egypt was the one that joined BRICS.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah. I mean, I don't follow that super closely, but I would assume that people out there probably thought that was going to happen. And, you know, and when that happened, it's like, you know, to us who don't follow, it's like, oh, that's kind of a big surprise. But if you're trading that and you're kind of looking at that deal and kind of looking at those things coming, you know, to fruition, it's not surprising to those people. It's kind of like the news events. Mm-hmm. Like it's, I feel like a lot of that's kind of baked in. And then when it happens, you're like me and Kyle who don't follow it are like, holy cow, like what a, you know, and you kind of, you know, you're a little surprised by it. But if you're watching the news and you, you know, you, if that's basing what your trades, like if you're trading a certain pair that is kind of, you know, relevant in that, and you're not aware of that, then that's kind of an issue, you know, but the thing is like, if you're trading that pair and they join or whatever, that's kind of baked into what you are already looking at. It, you know, like to me, that's like, it's like earnings a little bit. Like, you know, earnings are coming out. You don't know what they're going to be in the per share or whatever, but you can see the way that they're pricing stuff in. It's just a matter of that deadline of when that occurs.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. I couldn't agree more with you. I think it's already the pricing in. And real quick, so it was 3 days ago that like they announced Egypt was eligible. So I couldn't remember those other countries. And one of them was Argentina, which, you know, they put in their application before their elections. And I don't, the new president, he's going to dollarize the economy in Argentina. So I don't think that's going to happen. But, you know, I always make the joke that like everybody in BRICS hates each other. The other company, one of the other countries that joined was Ethiopia. Like, I made that joke not remembering that Ethiopia joined BRICS. Like, Egypt and Ethiopia, like, on the brink of war because of the Renaissance Dam. Like,
right.
Hilarious. This is like the kind of, they're trying to make a suicide squad.
That's their coalition.
No, I mean that's kind of my answer on it, too, which is that, you know, unless you're looking for this information, unless this information is pertinent to the exact type of trade you're trying to do, you know, these big global moves and these trade deals, I know it sounds goofy, but I don't know if they really translate to individual investments. I mean, unless you're like, you know, if you have a bunch of money, or say you're doing like, you know, there's a ton of option trading that people do on, as you guys know, on like shipping industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe like the Suez Canal being closed, or, you know, a lack of water in the Panama, you know, in the Panama Canal, or like the fact that it went from, you know, 4 days waiting to 35 day waitings to get through the Panama Canal is like, yeah, okay, yeah, no, you should know about that. Mr. Banks is 100% right. Like, it would be weird if you're like somebody who's so invested in that type of trading to like be unaware that the Suez Canal is effectively shut down, and which is, you know, gouged Egypt's public, foreign currency reserves. And now they need an IMF loan. Like, it would be strange if you didn't know that. I think sometimes, you know, obviously Kyle, Mr. Banks yell at me for saying this, but I think sometimes traders underestimate just how aware they are of many of these global trends. Like, they're probably more aware of it than the average Joe walking down the street.
That's a good point. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I did like that one. I'm gonna do my best to be the last time I mentioned bricks today. Because I made my piece on that so well.
Yeah, so yeah, I kind of agree with you guys there. Like, unless the deal is like specific to something that you're actually trading, I don't know how you can really bake that in. It probably really doesn't matter that much to you.
I mean, I think also trading, you know, trading on domestic equities, I think is also kind of interesting, because the U.S. is just its stock market is so massive. It's really everything is a function of domestic equities, even international equities, just because of the sheer size of our economy and our stock market. So, like, I don't want to give, you know, Charlie here some advice that's going to make him, you know, follow some YouTube rabbit hole at 3 o'clock in the morning. I think, Charlie, I think you're probably more well-versed than, you know, the guy sitting across from you on a trade.
I'd say, too, it depends on your time frame, too. I mean, if you're a short-term time trader like banks, myself, where you're trading intraday moves, like macro, I mean, it can give you some biases for, like, overall sentiments and maybe give you some key levels to look for based off of that. But unless you're trading on, like, a 3 to 6 month time frame, it probably doesn't make that much difference to you.
Right. I mean, it's fun. I think it's more fundamental. I think the fundamental effect is so much greater than these kind of these macro and these broader strokes that, you know, I think you're probably fine. I mean, I'll tell you, I was somebody, you know, when you talk about like macro issues, I went into the market the day Russia invaded Ukraine with bonds. And, you know, we were selling, I think, like $75 million in bonds. Everybody pulled out of the market, and our bond advisors, which was so cool because one of our bond advisors is a veteran-owned firm, and it's all combat veterans, which I just thought was so cool to have in something like this. They're like, yeah, don't worry about it. They're just like, stay in the market. And, you know, our primary underwriters told us to stay in, and we ended up getting like, we were like 75 basis points below the rest of the market. And then, you know, I had buddies who went and brought their debt in a week later, and they were, you know, 100, 150 basis points higher because of it. And I was like, well, that's good bond advisement, because you know what they said? They said, hey, bonds are, you're selling 20-year notes there, guys.
Yeah.
This is a one-day anomaly.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like the opposite of what you guys just talked about, but obviously my stuff's a little more, you know, longer distance in time.
Right.
No, I thought it was a good question, Charlie. I'm sorry to rant at you at the front.
I thought it was a good question, too. I think there's a lot of, like, especially when you first start getting into trading, you see a big move, you want to know why it happened. And then so you start going down this rabbit hole of looking for the news events. And then the longer you spend with it, the more you see, like, to Banks's point, like, the same news can give different results. Like, it was a beat, it went up last time, but this time it was a beat and it went down. What the fuck? Yeah. So you start to realize that until that uncertainty gets to play out, you're better off just sitting on your hands and waiting until you can kind of make sense of what's going on after the fact.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing with news. I mean, the way that I view news now is so, and I'm not saying this is all retail, but a lot of retail, I mean, the job of market makers and, you know, hedge funds or whatever, their job is to create liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
News events gives a great opportunity to create liquidity and to absolutely wreck the retail trader.
Right.
So, and that's why, like, I tell a lot of people, like, in our group, like, if you're newer to trading, like, don't trade the news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like on a perfect day, like, I would love to come into like an FOMC statement with a couple $100 under the belt to where I can risk, you know, that or be in a position to where I can risk it for a break even kind of trade or a break even kind of day. But if I'm coming in just blank on the day, there's no way that I'm coming in and trading FOMC, just because, you know, you get these swings that are 100 points wide on the NASDAQ, and, you know, you're entering in and all of a sudden you get slippage of 5-10 points. There's just no way to risk properly on these news events. And I completely get it, because when you're talking about liquidity and talking about how in the short term, how to create liquidity, it's an easy way to do it. You move the market 50 points this way, 100 points the other way, and all of a sudden you get all the stops from everyone.
Right.
So it's an easy way to do it.
Yep.
No, right on.
Well, I think we've got those questions answered. So hopefully if you got any other ones, send them our way. Try to keep them shorter if you can, so we don't spend half our time on answering those. But let's go ahead and let's move on to the stuff that we've got to cover for today, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. So Yeah, as Kyle brought up before, you know, today's topic is kind of the impact of fiscal and monetary policy on markets. And, you know, fiscal and monetary policy is something like, you know, I think they're pretty vogue terms, and talking to a lot of traders, talking to a lot of people in finance. I think, you know, kind of what we talked about a little earlier is that, you know, the average trader knows a lot about fiscal and monetary policy, even if they don't realize how much they know.
If you can quote the federal funds rate right now, you probably know more than the average person.
Oh, yeah. You know more than 99% of people, I'll say that. So a lot of, like, you know, kind of what the topic today is on, how do we translate these things? Like, what do they mean? What's important to look at? What's not important to look at? And, you know, particularly it's on, like, the taxation and spending side. Mm-hmm. You know, taxation and spending policy, so the type of fiscal policy, especially at the, you know, the national level, can be problematic in some trading scenarios, especially, you know, as Mr. Banks and Kyle previously talked about, especially around, like, FOMC, you know, when the Fed's in its open market position. Mm-hmm. Those can swing markets, and sometimes, actually, I'll say a lot of time, they are so infrequently predictable if it pushes them up or down, that, you know, just like Mr. Banks said, you can't really trade on that news. I actually, Mr. Banks said it perfectly. You have to be in a position prior to that news to be in a position to trade on that news.
Right.
So it's kind of like, it's like a two-step trade. Yep. And usually it's like, you know, larger investment firms are positioned like that. But, like, kind of, you know, in the point of this series when Kyle, you know, approached us about doing it is, like, you know, how do we make this information that's usable, maybe not for a trade tomorrow, but for your trades over, you know, your career. And so one of the things I really want to talk about is taxation, because taxation is a huge issue on, you know, government. When I'm talking about taxation, I'm talking about, you know, paying your personal taxes, call a CPA for that. I'm talking about, like, you know, when we start hearing taxation policies in the United States, you know, what does it mean for us? And one of the problems with taxation in a macroeconomic environment is that the U.S. is just so different than the rest of the developed world. So if we take the OECD, you know, which is, like, pretty much the 20 largest economies, you end up with, like, some really weird, you know, some really weird stuff when you look at the U.S. taxpayer. So, you know, kind of what thing I want to jump into is, when you hear about taxes going up, when you hear about them increasing the tax brackets, which, if they increase the tax bracket, that means taxes are effectively going down. But when you see this deficit spending, and when you see increasing national debt, and when you see these, you know, increased social programs, it's, traders are smart. They relate it to increased taxation, and you're right, that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But how much does that hurt the economy? All right, how much does increased taxation hurt the ability for people to engage in the economy? And the answer is, outside of the United States, it's pretty dramatic. Inside the United States, we have such a low marginal propensity of taxation. So marginal propensity of taxation basically is, like, how much more can you tax before it starts hurting the economy? Mm-hmm. And that's really a function of disposable income. And United States, like, you know, the United States is one of the top countries for income per capita, GDP per capita, all that stuff. But, like, everybody knows, like, the Luxembourgs and these other, you know, really Switzerland and these other really developed economies usually have a higher GDP per capita, income per capita. But, you know, 300 million person country versus, you know, country with less than a million, you really can't compare them.
No.
But what makes the United States crazy is that we have 20% more disposable income per capita than the number two guy, which is Luxembourg. That means the average you know, citizen in the United States can be taxed a lot more. I'm not advocating for more taxes, but it means.
Well, to be really cut clear that on that, real quick.
Because your mayorship.
Yeah, right. Right. So, but it's something where, like, traders shouldn't be, you know, really concerned when they talk about taxation in the long run affecting the ability for companies to generate profits, because there's so much disposable income per capita. I mean, the disposable income per capita in the United States, on a household level, just the disposable income, is higher than a lot of European nations' total household income.
No shit, really? And, even in Europe?
Yeah, yeah. Europe's strange. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of poor areas of Europe that, like, for some reason, like, get brushed under the rugs. Like Portugal's very poor, and so is Spain.
I mean, we kind of brush Florida under the rug, too, so, I mean.
Yeah, no, it's like, I have a lot of buddies in Europe, and every time they compare Europe to America, I'm always like, It's weird that you guys forget the Balkans are part of Europe.
Oh, yeah. Poor Greece.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, Germany's so much better than Mississippi. It's like, probably. But also, hear me out here, Massachusetts, the highest HDI in the world. And also, Serbia. Serbia is part of Europe. Dude, if you need to have the word and in your country name, like Bosnia and Herzegovina, like, there's probably some bad history there. Like, right. You got to fight putting the word and. Like, I mean, like, it's like Austria has a higher poverty rate and higher unemployment than the U.S. by a huge margin. It's like 50% higher than here. Wow. No, it's yeah. Yeah, that always blows my mind, like, the comparisons. Yeah, so we, you know, so when you hear this future tax increases as a trader, like, a lot of times I've personally seen this where U.S. tax conversation comes up. And the market goes down, and the market whipsaws more positive the next day than it went down because people got over that panic. And I wouldn't want a trader to accidentally get caught up in that stampede because they don't know about this. They don't know that disposable income in the United States is so high that we can absorb taxes like any, unlike any country on earth, because we have very high income, but we also have a very high percentage of disposable income.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. But what about things like corporate taxations or when like investments start getting taxed differently?
Yeah, so the investment taxation is kind of interesting here because, you know, income tax is a little bit of a weird beast because you get taxed on your income as a gross percentage, right? Like, you know, it's not like all your living expenses and you get taxed on what's ever remaining, where obviously capital gains tax and taxes like those are taxed after you're profitable. You know, for traders, especially like, you know, probably a lot of traders who listen to the show who have such a good feel for the market that they're really escalating their their returns, especially and it's falling into the short-term capital gains. That can be problematic, and one of the strategies that I've seen, you know, employed, and this is obviously a little out of my expertise, is certainly in, you know, yours and Mr. Bank's strategy, is that I have seen people who have had great, you know, short, really targeted the market and had, you know, fully assaulted some industry, did great. And I'll see them transition their profits, or sometimes transition most of their position into like tax free municipal debt, or like they'll just be like, "There's my profit. I'm going to let that sit over there for a year because I don't want to get hammered on tax rate." And the funny thing to me about that is, like the U.S. government kind of wants you to do that. It's like the tax is like the tax is working. You're keeping your capital in the market. So it's not inherently a bad thing. And it can be good for the economy. But like when you hear about a new tax plan, when you hear about taxes going up in the future, when you hear about it, or more importantly, we rarely ever hear about taxes going up. Usually if you look at the news, we hear about tax relief expiring. It's not a threat to the market. We're not at a point where it's a threat to the U.S. economy. We would have to see taxes increase some estimates like 20-30% before we even start even approaching the, you know, the number two spot in disposable income. So like nobody likes taxes going up. I don't want taxes to go up, but it's not, the ship's not sinking. This is somebody spilling a bucket of water on the deck. It's not a wave coming over the top.
Right. It's blown a little more out of proportion than probably should be.
Yeah, it's a good news story. It's right. A good news story.
So that's interesting.
And then corporate taxations.
I've never thought of the long-term capital gain the way that you just put it, in the sense of staying actually in the market.
Yeah,
that's an interesting way to put it. And even for non-traders, that's interesting just because of the fact, like small businesses and stuff like that. I mean, I've just never viewed it that way before. I've always the end goal of what that tax is the main piece. I've never actually thought about how the interim means and what that means to everyone else, which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, anytime you can keep capital in the economy, it's going to spur growth. Yeah. And yeah, it's actually, I think, a pretty good tax policy.
Yeah, right.
If there has to be one.
Yeah, I'll stop bitching about capital gains, I suppose.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't want to go that far, buddy. I don't.
As long as I don't raise that one.
Angry tweets at me.
Make sure I name this episode. We do not condone raising taxes. Okay, so that kind of covers a little bit about like the taxation and that aspect of it. But you also mentioned like fiscal policy as one of the other items.
Yeah, so like fiscal policy is like weird because it includes everything. Because like I think it gets, you know, I think it does revolve a lot around taxation policy. But fiscal policy is cool because it's like the decisions governments make. Mm-hmm. And fiscal policy can be something as non-market related as European nations choosing to have like really aggressive welfare systems and wealth and like healthcare over, you know, military investment. That's a fiscal mm-hmm. policy. But more important to traders, I think a lot of the fiscal policy has less, can really be focused, you know, less on those types of, you know, really global exchanges or really, no, I shouldn't say global, but like really top level exchanges, like things like military spending and healthcare and science and stuff like that. And I think you'd be more focused on the government picking winners and losers in a market and how that affects different companies. I think if you look at, especially like something like AI that's coming up, you know, something mm-hmm. like topical is AI, where like how is government going to choose to regulate things like deep fakes? How are they going to choose to regulate like data hallucinations?
Right.
Where, you know, that probably seems a little detached from, say, fiscal policy. But at the end of the day, you know, government runs on money. Everything runs on money. And how they're going to choose to tax like investment in AI. You know, I had a, you know,
longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
I had a little off topic from economics, or, you know, from a, you know, academic view of economics. Mm-hmm. I was speaking at a conference recently, and I ran into this gentleman who's a venture capital investor in tech. And he's been doing this since like the 80s, and he is a wicked interesting guy. And I got a chance to pick his brain. And yeah, it was one of the best things about speaking at conferences. So like, people will come to you to talk, and you get to talk to them, and you get to actually like, I'm like, dude, I'm gonna take this opportunity to pick your brain. So I said to him, I go, how does this work? Like, tech is no longer hardware. Tech is no longer like, you know, physical things. It's not capital, it's labor. And he goes, no, that, he goes, that's the biggest problem, is that like companies don't need more money. They need more expertise. Mm. And I was like, wow, I never, as a labor economist, I probably should have thought it that way. But, and one of the, and he a little embarrassing. So he said to me, he said, you know, it's going to be interesting how the government handles this. If you don't have capital to tax, you don't have capital gains to tax. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you're going to have higher income tax, or are you going to have income that's, you know, are you going to say the usage of AI is a capital usage or stuff like that? I don't know.
Oh, like a different kind of payroll tax.
Right. And that leads to kind of some interesting questions. And I know, you know, I always like giving like real examples. That's a real example of what a trader needs to be looking at for when they're trying to think of how fiscal policy can affect their investments. Is it going to affect day-to-day trading? No, I don't. I think fiscal policy moves too slow to do that. But it is something that I do strongly recommend following as a trader, because it may let you get in front of that next curve. It may let you know where that next, you know, roadblock's going to be, because fiscal policy is a roadblock.
So like looking at it through like that lens, was like the boom of the internet, was that something that was a little bit more apparent if you go back and look at the way fiscal policy was working around it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Kyle, I think internet's like a great example. I remember reading, you know, back in like when I was in college, so back in like the early 2010s, well, one of my professors made us read a bunch of like analysts on mm-hmm. the internet. And one analyst was like, you know, the internet's great for, and he lists off all these great things. Like, and this is back in like the mid 90s, he was 100% right about like email. He was 100% right about data stuff. But he ended it with saying, you know, it's the internet. Nobody's going to buy dog food off the internet.
Yeah. Wrong.
Chewy, which has like one of the best evaluations. Yeah. And a lot of reasons why, like, you know, the U.S. internet, or the U.S. dominated internet, you know, was a little bit, sorry, it was a lot based on the technology, and, you know, previous to the internet having, like, the web, was really helpful. Like, you know, we were already there. NASA was huge, and, like, there was a lot of good things that caused it. But the fiscal policy of the United States government doesn't get so specialized, doesn't get so specific to really hinder this. Where some countries, that doesn't become a problem. So when I talk about fiscal policy, and I talk about, like, you know, what if, you know, as an economist talking to traders, what do I want you to consider in fiscal policy? Fiscal policy should be what you look at to kind of understand the direction of the U.S. government. Are they putting more investment into something? Are they trying to pick winners? Are they trying to pick losers? What industries are going to win and lose? Mm-hmm. And what positions do you have within those industries? Because at the end of the day, government's the biggest player in the market. And they do have the ability to pick winners and losers, whether we want them to or not. And just kind of just be having your ears open and looking and doing that critical step, asking that critical question, making that critical step of being, all right, this policy is coming here. It's good. My holdings within these four industry clusters could be threatened. Mm-hmm. You know, like personally, like I just, with how the government's been talking about TikTok, and, you know, TikTok certainly built like this really interesting model. And I could see if TikTok gets banned, you know, other publicly traded companies like, you know, like a Snapchat, which, you know, has had a little bit of a rough go, but knowing that policy is going to be coming around the corner, you know, and while that's not a pure fiscal policy, it's the same exact effect as if it was a fiscal policy. There's no difference in effect.
That's actually kind of a fascinating way of looking at it. Looking at the way that the government is interacting with the industries in order to try to pick, like, the, and this is more for like 5-10 year down the road. Like, you're looking for the next automobile, you're looking for the next internet.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
You know, and then even on like kind of a different scale, let's talk about, I mean, have you guys seen the new Toyota Champ truck?
No, I don't think I have.
I have not seen it.
Is it electric?
No. Okay. I don't think it is. So it's a bare bones truck. Has no radio in it. Has no nothing. It's like, it's a Champ Helix.
Is that the like $2,000 one that you can buy from, like, get delivered to your house?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so you're not going to get them in the U.S.
No, because we have a lot of safety rules.
No. And on top of that, it's because if you transfer a truck into the United States and it's a 2-seater, you get taxed at like 25%. But if it's 4-seaters, that's not considered a cargo truck. So you only get taxed like 5%. I think the tariff's like 4.5% actually.
Wow.
So when you have a really, really cheap vehicle that relies on being a really, really cheap market point,
right?
You can't, I'll tell you what people usually do. So Ford makes a lot of its escorts and stuff. No, escorts, the transits and transit connects. Mm-hmm. They make them a Turkey and they actually like bolt 2 seats to the back of them. Transfer them to the United States, they get the 5% tax, and then they remove the 2 seats in a factory, which if you, God love those people, I'm happy they have jobs, but if you ever think you're useless, being the guy who either installs those useless seats or removes them, can't make you feel good. Like that just can't. I'm happy you have a job. If you're listening to this, I'm so happy you have a job and you're interested in trading, but I hope you're doing okay.
That job is saving a lot of money to Ford.
Yes, it is. So, like, the other option is, like, you send all the different pieces of the truck in and then reassemble it. Well, the problem is that, like, American labor is wicked expensive, so you can't send all the raw parts that make up, you know, this new truck without, you know, it being, you know, starts to get priced at, like, a Maverick, and nobody's going to buy this truck over a Maverick.
Right.
And you're not going to just, again, your price point's garbage if you throw, you know, 2 seats. You have no place to throw the 2 extra seats. So we're just not going to have them. And that's a fiscal policy. So if you were like amped up looking at Toyota, like, oh yeah, I'm really hoping, like, I'm going to take a 6-month position on Toyota because I want to see how the Champ's going to sell in the United States, because there's huge demand. There's evidence of huge demand for what Toyota did. You may want to not take that position because it's not going to help out in the larger truck market. What you may want to do is look at what companies have aged truck stock, which Dodge would be one of them, Dodge Ram. Could they put out something like this? We see this in the market already. We see, like, the Transit Connect leading to like the Dodge, I forget what the Dodge Roadmaster, but those little basically small panel vans, and then Chevy also has one. So like now that Toyota triggered this in the market, is somebody going to steal this idea? Like we know, they know there's demand here. And so that's where like a fiscal policy about how you deal taxation, which crazy reason why we have that tax, by the way, you're going to see, hey, that fiscal policy caused something in the market that could weaken a position, even though I was very you know, bullish on Toyota after this announcement. Well, this fiscal policy sitting over here and government makes the rules, totals that trade, like absolutely makes that trade unfeasible.
That's an awesome example, but how do you know those things? Like, where do you find that information?
I mean, I consume probably like 20, 30 hours of news either by reading or listening.
Uh-huh.
So you gotta turn to this podcast. That would be what I tell listeners. You gotta make sure you set that reminder.
Or go to your TED Talks.
Yeah, no, my TED Talks are boring. No, I'm just because I'm a boring person. The people who put them on are actually interesting.
Great.
But that's what you gotta do. It's all these little pieces of information that combine together, and that's why like. When I have the good fortune to talk to like real traders like you and Mr. Banks, I sit here and go like, I have no idea how you guys don't just have like one industry you get wicked involved in. Like, it blows my mind that you guys are able to like dance across different industries. Like, I'm like, I find that exhausting, and I'm somebody who just listens to news to be more informed. Like, if you want to have we could go on a 40-minute discussion about how the Democratic Republic of the Congo's elections went last week. I have some minutes, but like, you know, this. But yeah, I mean, that's why if you're industry specific, you can look at industry specific, you know, fiscal policy is another example of that.
So it's almost like it might be better off specializing if you really want to start to dive into some of these things.
Yeah. And you know, economics supports that, like specialization is always better than generalization.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. What about, we talked about this before and you've given an explanation, but I feel like it'd probably be a good one to cover again since we're talking about fiscal policy. But one thing that's in the news a lot is the ridiculous amount of debt that the country is carrying.
Yeah.
Is that something that people should be scared from?
My personal view on that is no. Mm-hmm. It's funny because one of the big reasons I got into economics when I was younger, like I'm a weirdo. I knew I wanted to be an economist when I was like 15, 16 years old.
Weird.
It is weird because I'm just a weird person who like wants to listen to news and be able to like, oh, I need to know why this works. Like, right. I wish I was like, I don't know. I wish I could just like sit at home and be like, oh, I'm going to like watch this UFC fight. I would think I'd be much, much happier person. My wife would be much happier.
Just have to hear about the elections.
Dude, she comes like, I'll be like watching TV and she comes up. She's like, why are you listening to somebody give like a 35-minute lecture on like some obscure tax policy? I'm like, oh, this is fascinating. She's like, it's not, it's objectively not fascinating. I got really into economics because of the national debt, and I was so scared of it when I was, you know, when I first got into here. I was like, this is crazy, we're totally screwed, like this is going to destroy America, we're Rome, well, you know, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's how I felt like that for years. And then one day I'm talking to a professor I had who's like my mentor. And he says to me, he goes, Eric, what did we get for that debt? And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, what did we get for that debt? He goes, you know, we got capital. We built roads. We built bridges. We bought trucks. And whatever country holds the debt got pieces of paper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the largest country that holds our debt is the U.S. It's U.S. citizens, followed by Japan, followed by China. And he said, what's more valuable, a tractor or a piece of paper?
Hmm.
I was like, oh. Hmm. Tractor. He goes, yeah, tractor's a piece of capital, piece of paper is what you need.
That's it. Hold on, wait a second. Just Banks, you do work for a bank, right? You do personal loans?
Yeah, I mean, I do all kinds of loans.
Just thinking of all kinds of stuff I wouldn't mind having that'd probably be more valuable than a piece of paper.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, and I'm talking about from a small industry. Like, people ask me about the national debt, and kind of my answer is, well, who else would you back your money behind? Yeah, you know, right. And that's the easy answer is, I mean, you know, you look at other, you know, economies that you could kind of say, well, Germany, it's like, well, nah, not really. I mean, you know, and then you look at other economies where you say like, you know, well, you know, China's the best manufacturer. Well, do you really want to put your money in China? You know, so it's like, you know, where would you place your money if you're going
to. They tend to get mad every 50, 100 years and attack the world.
Yeah.
Stay away from Germany.
Is that a World War II joke? Love it.
So,
yes. Roll it in there.
Sorry.
Love it. Don't apologize.
Just out of curiosity, when you first got into being an economist, what was the national debt at that standpoint?
It was like early Obama. So about probably like 11, 12 trillion dollars.
So we've tripled.
So yeah. So what's that to GDP? That probably would have been 70-80% of GDP.
Okay.
Give or take. Absolutely. Like I'm not a huge fan of the current debt situation. Don't get me wrong, because like it's been spurred by, you know, large deficit spending.
Yeah.
I'm not the biggest Ronald Reagan fan, but like he spent the national debt, but we saved a bunch of money in the long run because he ran up the national debt for defense spending and crushed the Soviet Union.
Right.
Like that saved us money in the long run. I know that's all. Yeah. Like, many other things happened, but like we saved money in the long run. That's one of the ways to look at it. But, you know, one of the ways, I became, you know, more enlightened on the conversation, I became somebody who professionally, you know, looks at this, because I feel like no matter what field you are in economics, you have to be able to talk about the national debt. At first, I was like, you know, I went from this is horrible, what is this, you know, really, you know, anxious about it, to like, oh, it's nothing to worry about. Everybody who's worried about the national debt, it's just, you know, 19-year-old Eric is like, everybody doesn't understand. They just don't understand it.
Man.
And then as I matured a little bit, I was like, no, there's a really cool nuanced discussion here. Because not all dollars of debt are the same. A dollar debt from deficit spending is super problematic. And that's what we have right now. That's why that part of national debt, you know, concerns me.
Explain that a little bit. Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So if the government is spending more in its operational budget, its yearly budget, than it's taking in tax collections, we call that like, that's what a deficit is, which we all know that. Mm-hmm. But we call that like deficit debt, which means that dollar doesn't just occur now. It occurs every single year. As opposed to capital investment, which is like building a road. Mm-hmm. So you can spend $1 trillion on roads and, you know, that asset's going to return, you know, it's right. going to have a return over time, but 2%, give or take, sometimes less. But it's not like you're spending that trillion over and over again.
But when you're borrowing money to pay the senator's salaries,
yeah,
there's not much of an ROI on that.
No, there's literally none. Yeah, but exactly, you know, Kyle, exactly. There isn't that the same return as capital investment. So if you're running up a national debt because you're doing a lot of like capital investment, that's fantastic. Like Biden's infrastructure plan, which I've read all the way through. I read ARPA all the way through. I read CARES Act all the way through. And I read the Biden infrastructure plan all the way through. You know, there's weird stuff in the Biden one. But broadly speaking, like it's Title B. If anybody in here is like, I want to try and take, you know, it, like there's a great ETF called PAVE, PAVE, that's like all like construction, like infrastructure investment. If somebody's like, I'm gonna take a position in that, look up Title B in the Biden infrastructure plan. That'll tell you all you need to know. It's like really specific on like multimodal transportation and stuff like that. It is quite interesting. But yeah, you know, that's the, you know, different debt for different cases is really right. What it comes down to in there.
All right. I think that answers my question. Banks, do you have any other questions of anything we've talked about?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think I had some questions on the interest rates and stuff like that, but I think that's probably in a later discussion.
I think we have a little bit of time. We got about 5 or 10 minutes left.
Yes. Yeah, so let me ask you this. So on the debt that's being put out and being spent, when rates are going up like this, because, you know, I'm coming at it from a banking standpoint. Obviously, when rates are going up, the higher interest you're paying. So in the sense of fighting inflation, you raise rates. But is that kind of counterintuitive a little bit in the sense of paying the actual debt?
Yeah. No, so it's super counterintuitive because basically the United States and Mr. Banks, you hit the home run on national debt before it's at. U.S. national debt is different than every other country because yeah. We're borrowing in the U.S. dollar. So imagine like borrowing money from the bank and you have the printer for the bank.
Right.
And you also have the world's most powerful military.
Yeah.
Really do whatever you want. We are real. We're a really nice country. Like in historic context, we're a really nice country. So, no, I mean, yeah. So it is super counterintuitive. It really is, because you're increasing borrowing costs to try and hedge inflation, and the U.S. government has to take, you know, gets hurt more than anybody else. I always say that, like, everybody complains about, oh, higher interest rates for the houses and stuff like that. I'm like, no, the U.S. government is actually being really responsible, because it's basically saying, I'm going to pay more money to stop this inflation. Mm-hmm. So the idea, you know, there's really two ways that we see this type of inflation getting stopped by raising rates. The first is, you raise rates, people simply, you know, things start to not necessarily cost more, but the value of the dollar is more valuable sitting in an investment account or sitting in a savings account. So you see dollars retreat from the economy because they're better off being invested. So that's really good, because investments, which drive solar growth model, drives economic growth. It's great. So that's one way it tampers it down. There's less exchange. You reduce exchange. If you reduce the amount of exchange in an economy, you're really hampering one of the major parts of inflation. Sometimes it's called, like, pull inflation is, like, sometimes a term used. Some economists like to use this, like, push or pull inflation. Academically, it's a great discussion. I don't think it's a good discussion when we're talking about this, because it's some of these kind of, like, vaguer concepts. But the underlying concept of this, like, how do you raise rates? So the first one is, you know, like I said, take dollars out of the economy, less exchange. The second one's actually kind of interesting, and we're seeing in the housing market right now, which is, it makes, despite, you know, inflation weakens dollars, but I always say, in this environment, you're making the dollar less effective as a tool of spending. So even though you may want to go, like, buy a house, you can tamper a housing market by increasing rates, because Mr. Banks, you probably see this all the time. You have the house of the same value, but you increase the interest rate. And if you increase that interest rate, the house becomes effectively more expensive, which reduces transactions, which means the person selling the house has to lower the price to account for this increased interest rate. What do we call price drop? Deflation. Mm-hmm. Apply that to every good in the economy, and you have not deflation, but you have a slowing down of inflation. We don't want deflation. If deflation's bad, deflation would be really bad.
Okay. And then part two to that question would be, you know, I know everyone wants to, in one way, pay the debt down or pay it off, you know, because if you're coming at it from just a normal consumer, you want to be debt free. Coming at it from a business and from a banker, not all debt is bad debt.
Right.
So, and that's where, like, I guess my question to you would be, in the grand scheme of things in today's world, what would the ideal debt be in the U.S.?
I mean, it's a hard number to hit. I think the ideal debt would grow slower than GDP. I think that would be one of the descriptors of it. I think it would be a very small percentage of deficit debt.
Okay.
I think, you know, balanced budget. Every unit of government in the United States, besides the federal government, has to have a balanced budget by law. Like, I have to have a balanced budget by law. If I have to raise taxes if I can't make it up. So I think that would be part of it. I think if your GDP is growing by 2%, if your GDP is up, say, 5%, 5.2%, like it was last quarter, and your debt's growing at an annual rate of 3%, I think that's pretty good. That means you're getting a 2% return on your investment, which for government's fantastic. I think another component of, like, the ideal debt situation would be, you know, debt that's well structured when it's taken out. And what I mean by that, and I know that's kind of a weird answer, is, like, you're taking out, you're selling 20-year treasuries for building a road.
Mm-hmm.
You're selling 10-year treasuries for financing, like, military equipment or something like that. You're not running a massive deficit and then taking out a bunch of interlocking short-term treasuries, basically doing a faux RAN, or revenue anticipation note, till you catch up. I think that's like using a credit card to pay your monthly bills and racing to, you know, to your next paycheck.
Yeah.
It's a payday loan.
Kyle, you literally, I could not think of the analogy. You said it clean on the head. That was perfect. You know, so I think it's about structure. And I finally do want to say, I very much agree with the point that zero debt's bad. So one of the hardest things I had to get over when I became a CFO of a city is that, like, I want zero debt. I want no debt. And the previous treasurer, who's excellent, probably one of the best public sector treasurers that I'll ever meet in my life, she goes, no. And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, this isn't, like, the city's not a house. you know, the federal, you know, the United States public assets are not a house where you pay it off and, well, yeah, that's great. The vast majority of government spending is investment in maintenance, mm-hmm. in maintaining roads, maintaining bridges, maintaining a military, maintaining, you know, all these things. When you stop that investment, that's problematic.
Right.
And, you know, as somebody who's been on, I think I've been on like 65 S&P rating calls in my career so far. She was 100% right. You know, S&P thinks you stop investing in the asset and maintenance. They're like, whoa, you just did a $200 million school and now you're not borrowing anything to maintain that school. That's, you know, that's not a good sign. And, you know, I kind of look at that too.
That'd like, be your warning sign for an impending recession.
Yeah, right. Like if the government's just like, we're not going to maintain. Wait a minute. Oh, it's a bad example. Did not maintain roads.
Sorry, Arkansas, Oklahoma.
Yeah, this Biden infrastructure bill, man, like it's crazy. Like it's strange. Like it has all this great stuff in there about like roadway improvements and bridge programs and ferry improvements and all this stuff. But it's also like you got $40 million on electric buses in low-income communities. And I'm like, I think we should do something to address the low-income part of that. And I don't think that's electric buses. I think there's like...
Right. There's other steps that we're missing.
It's giving somebody a parachute that's on a boat that's sinking. It's like, you know, this is a use. Parachutes are useful. I'm not disagreeing with that. But I need a life jacket, not a parachute.
How about an education? Let's start there.
Yeah, like... I'm going to probably sound like a little bit like, you know, a little loft than I'm used to sounding, but like, I love the idea of like free community college and like free trade school.
Mm-hmm.
I love that idea. I tell you, it's better than minimum wage.
That's probably the best return on your investment as a country you can get is by investing in the education of your people.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And then, you know, the United States gets a benefit because other countries invest in the education of their students mm-hmm. and their kids, and they come over here. I mean, it's a win-win for us. Like, we should be doing on both ends.
Man, I think we covered quite a bit today, but I feel like we touched everything. Is there anything we missed?
I do want to throw one thing out, and Kyle and Mr. Banks, I know I shared it earlier. One of the things, and I mentioned, you know, we talked about in the last show, and I just want to, that little Google Docs I put together with some links to some of the stuff I talked about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I also included in there a little chart that includes the high-quality market bonds, which are corporate bonds that are rated AA, AAA, which are usually what public sector bonds in the United States are rated, minus about 100, 150 basis points of their tax-free right now. But I will say when rates are lower, you don't get that 150 basis point tax versus tax-free spread. But I include that in there. And those are the best data series from Fred to follow. And I also included all the monetary base, M1, M2, M3, to follow along with kind of some of the topics we discussed today. And those is if you wanted to start rolling in certain macroeconomic data into your investment life and into your trading life, I think those are some really good fundamentals to start with.
Awesome. Can we link that document or?
Yeah, sure. So I unlocked it. Okay. So anybody can go check it out.
Just make sure they can't edit it.
Oh, that'd be
find it all that. Deleted.
That would be so funny.
It would be hilarious.
Poor Charlie's gonna like be in there writing curse words about me.
Oh no, right? Didn't answer my question.
Should be able to edit it. Never. No, you don't like bricks.
Anything else you got going on that you want to let everyone know about, Eric? I think you got a TED Talk coming up. Anybody in Boston?
Yeah, so I have a TED Talk coming up. We're actually waiting for when we can release like all the information on it, but it's on March 30th in Boston. It's open to the public, and I'll be happy to share that information pretty soon. But you know, it's going to be in the medical field, and I'm going to be talking about the cost of cure,
fascinating.
Yeah, so talking about how like medical advancements, we pay for research and development with the cost of things today. I'm pretty sure you guys, obviously Kyle and Mr. Banks know, but I'm a type 1 diabetic, mm-hmm. so insulin, poster child for high cost, but a lot of that high cost comes because we're innovating medicine that, you know, my great-grandfather's type 1 diabetic, he had crushed up beef pancreas is how he got his insulin.
Right.
I get my insulin through genetically modified E. coli bacteria. You know, we pay for these, if we limit the price of drugs now, you know, we could be giving away cures tomorrow. We should be looking to increase access, not just arbitrarily lower prices.
Right. That's a good point. Is that going to be streamed?
Yeah, so they'll do. They should be having a live stream, and then they should also be doing a recording package afterwards.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, if they do the, if you could share that with us, because I wouldn't mind tuning in on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, Kyle.
Yeah, may as well.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for today's episode. So thank you to Eric for joining us, putting this thing together. Thank you, Banks, for the amazing questions and for helping make me look smarter than I am. If you want, you can check out theinformaleconomist.com to see more of Eric's work. And if you have any questions about what was covered today, email or DM us. We'll be sure to make sure they get answered in the next installment. We'll be back soon in your ears with another exciting episode. But until then, smash that 5-star rating like it's lowering your taxes, and take care. This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations. Produced by China Shop Productions.